Support for The Full Story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
Today, many want to start families later in life, but sometimes it can be hard to get pregnant. New York and Connecticut want to do their part to help, but sometimes the services aren't there. This is The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Rebecca Saran, in for Ron Ropiak. Today, we're going to talk about different fertility options in our region, what's working, and what families want from the states. In New York, residents now have greater access to in vitro fertilization, better known as IVF. It's several medical procedures a woman or couple decides to undergo when they want to start a family, but they're having trouble or she wants to have a child on her own. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. James Stelling. He is the medical and laboratory director at Stony Brook Medicine Island Fertility. Dr. Stelling, thanks for joining us today on The Full Story.
Thank you for having me.
I know that you campaigned in Albany for some of the laws that we're going to be talking about today. I know one state law went into effect this year that requires insurance companies to cover IVF and fertility preservation services. How tough was it to get that law through?
It was tough. Me, as well as Resolve, which is the National Infertility Support Group Network, have been going to Albany probably for the last 6-7 years to campaign for increased access to IVF. The versions we were supporting for the last multiple years included the easier fertility treatments as well as the more complicated treatments like IVF. We were hoping to get it for all people in New York, including large people who work for large companies as people who work for smaller companies. But for many complicated reasons, the bill that did pass and took effect January 1st, it couldn't include the small group insurance category, so it was only in the large group categories, which is definitely a step in the right direction to definitely increase the access for people doing IVF, because on IVF, even though it can be very successful, is very expensive, can easily be $20,000 if you include all the medications, and that is, it's not a promise of getting pregnant, it's a good chance of getting pregnant, but it's hard to gamble $20,000, and if things look good, you flip a coin and hope you get pregnant. So having better IVF coverage definitely will make it more available for more patients.
So what was the reaction from lawmakers that pushed back? Was it that this was going to be a burden on companies?
Complicated, depends on the difference between large companies and small companies. The large companies, it was felt that the companies could handle the burden of the increased cost for the workers. For the smaller companies, it gets complicated, but in the Obamacare mandates from multiple years ago, if the New York State mandates a new treatment must be covered, then the state must cover that medical care. So it's not coming through the insurance anymore. So if New York had passed the IVF coverage for all the small companies in New York State would, and the taxpayers would have actually been paying for the IVF care. And that was the reason why these small group people were not able to be included in the bill that passed.
Oh, I see. So those that were part of the exchange or those that are the smaller companies, then that passes along to the state.
Yes.
Are there any restrictions now with this new requirement for insurance coverage in terms of, is this coverage regardless of age, marital status, sexual orientation, gender identity?
They are trying to be very LGBTQ friendly, so it should be including all people. I don't think the law had an age cutoff. Historically, many insurance companies have had an age cutoff of 45 years old. I don't think the law has that in there.
Yeah, you mentioned a moment ago about IVF, and it's somewhat complicated. Explain to us the kind of the process somebody would go through or a couple would go through versus a traditional pregnancy.
Obviously, traditional patients, couples are romantic, and they get pregnant, and hopefully without any problems. But in IVF, and we don't always start off with IVF. We sometimes start off with medications and inseminations if people have okay sperm and okay tubes. IVF was invented for patients who have bad tubes. It became the best thing for people who have bad sperm because you can take a single egg, a single sperm, inject the sperm into the egg to maximize the chance of it fertilizing. So to maximize the chance of getting pregnant, though, you don't want to just get one egg or one sperm. We try to make as many eggs as we can, average being around 10 eggs. So if a patient comes in with a cycle today, we commonly do fertility injections. They are taught to give themselves injections. They take these injections about for 10 days. And once their eggs are of an appropriate size, they take a different shot to trigger ovulation. But before the egg would get released, we do what we call an IVF egg retrieval, which in my office or at other fertility centers, we have a full operating room where there's an anesthesiologist who can come to give them anesthesia to put them to sleep and to wake them up. They're only asleep for about 10 minutes. There's no incisions. It's just an ultrasound-guided needle aspiration of the follicles. And each follicle we drain, we get the egg out of it. And then the patient wakes up and goes home, and we get another sperm sample from her partner at that time. If we have normal eggs, normal sperm, we just mix them together and let Darwin figure out which sperm is going to fertilize the eggs. And if we have bad sperm, you can take a single egg, a single sperm, inject the sperm into the egg, and that's called ICSI, or intracytoplasmic sperm injection. But ultimately, if I have an egg in my hand, about 6 or 7 or 60 to 70% of eggs will fertilize out of the person who might have 10. After fertilization, we then grow the embryos in the laboratory for about 5 days, and that's most commonly when we put them back in. For an embryo transfer, most patients are awake for that process, and it's kind of like having a pap smear. They are also on hormones for the second half of the cycle, estrogen and progesterone, to try to keep the uterine lining ready. And after you put them in, then we kind of keep our fingers crossed and hope that they're pregnant. If they're a good prognosis of patients, meaning they're young, have decent egg quality, the chance of getting pregnant per month is about 50%. And if the patients are older and the embryo quality may not be as good, success rates can be a lot lower than that. So unfortunately, it might cost someone $20,000, and if things look good, I flip a coin and hope they get pregnant. But if they have tails, they may have to do it again. We do have the ability to freeze embryos. So if someone makes 10 eggs and we put in the best one, there might be one or two other ones left over to freeze. And a frozen IVF cycle is a lot easier and simpler to go through, with very good success rates also.
And is that true too of a second child?
If they do the fresh cycle and they don't get pregnant that cycle, the following month they can use the frozen embryos to get pregnant. If they do get pregnant, those embryos can be frozen for a year or 2 years or 5 years without any detriment to the embryo, and have a good chance of getting pregnant for second children in the future, yes.
So you understand after you go through, you just stepped through that process, why it is so expensive, frankly. Do you see ways that the cost can be cut? A cost of treatment through regulations or a different, maybe advances in technology?
It's going to be hard because the medications that they're on for these to make these eggs can currently cost easily $5,000, can easily be $8,000 in just medication costs. And it's going to be hard to bring that down because the medications have changed gradually over the years. So the medications from 20 years ago might theoretically be cheaper, but now they're new and improved, and the prices tend to stay high. So the medications will usually say minimum of $5,000. For the IVF process, what you do at the fertility center, we're doing blood work and ultrasounds. Like in the, say, 2 weeks you're taking medications to make the eggs, you might be in the office 6-7 times and have 6-7 ultrasounds and 6-7 blood tests for different hormones, estrogen and progesterone and things like that. Individually, each individual blood test may not be expensive, but if I do, and we commonly do 3 different bloods in most of the day, so it could easily be 30 blood tests, which takes time, as well as the staffing to do all the ultrasounds. And so running an IVF center, we just built our IVF center, and ballpark, it cost about $5 million to build, if you look at all the equipment and the technology in the laboratory for the incubators and micromanipulators are very expensive pieces of equipment with very expensive staff running them. Our largest expense is not actually the equipment. It's actually going to be the staff, the embryologists who are doing all the work, and all the nursing who are taking care of the patients during the time. Some people do what's called micro-IVF or mini-IVF, and they do take less medications, but it's also less successful. It also requires less work in the lab part, so they can charge less. But again, because it's less successful, it's not the ideal way to go in most situations.
I know you mentioned you just opened up this brand new fertility practice. What kind of a demand are you seeing?
I'm booked for the next month for new patient consults, and there's tons of patients out there who need help. Not all of them need IVF. We commonly start off with things like medication inseminations first. But if they don't get pregnant, then they do progress into the IVF direction quite frequently. More common also in the future, and this is part of the fertility bill that just passed, fertility preservation for medical reasons now is covered by all insurance companies, both large and small, have to cover fertility preservation for medical reasons.
And what is that, doctor?
Say if a male is just diagnosed with a cancer of some kind and they're going to need some chemotherapy, we can freeze his sperm. So if after he's cured 5 years from now, we can use his frozen sperm to get his partner pregnant at that time. And that historically has not been covered well by insurance companies, but now it is for male sperm freezing, as well as for women. If a woman has diagnosed with whether it's breast cancer or a lymphoma or a leukemia, we commonly can freeze their eggs if they're single. We can freeze embryos if they have a partner to maximize the chance of getting pregnant in the future. And now with this bill that took effect January 1st, all insurance companies have to pay for medically indicated fertility preservation.
Are there still any bills on the table that you're going to be working toward to help, further enable IVF availability to residents in New York?
We still will campaign. Like, we didn't get the IVF coverage for everybody in New York, only the large companies. We're still working on trying to include the smaller companies. We're working potentially with the insurance agency of the New York State Insurance Regulatory Agency to try to change a past law. One of the past fertility bills from ballpark 20 years ago said medications and inseminations and the diagnostic workup of infertility have to be covered, but there was one sentence that said IVF does not have to be covered. So the presence of that one sentence is why there's a problem in New York. Because for other diseases, if someone has cancer, there's not a bill or a law related to whether this chemo has to be covered or not. If the insurance regulatory agency thinks it's an appropriate treatment, then it must be covered by the insurance companies. And we're trying to attack it that way with insurance regulatory agencies now. So,
all right.
Like I said, IVF is the standard. It's the best treatment we have, and it should be open for more people.
All right. Dr. James Stelling, thank you so much for joining us today. When we come back, we'll take a short break, and we'll speak with parents about the steps they took to have a family through a surrogate. Stay with us. And you're part of the full story on WSHU. I'm Rebecca Sarandon for Ron Ropiak. We've been talking about how IVF can help New Yorkers start families. Another way that people want to try to have a child is through gestational surrogacy. The problem is that New York is one of just three states where it is still illegal. Joining us now is Jen Rackman. She is an outreach associate for Circle Surrogacy in the New York area, and she is a parent who went through surrogacy. Hi, Jen. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us today is Anthony Brown. He is a New York-based attorney working to legalize gestational surrogacy in the state. He's also a parent through surrogacy. Welcome to the program as well, Anthony.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, I have to be honest with both of you. I knew all about surrogacy. However, I really didn't know how to define gestational surrogacy. For the other listeners out there like me, Jen, why don't you define it for us?
Sure. So gestational surrogacy is when you have a gestational surrogate, a carrier, who is able to carry a pregnancy for an individual, a couple, for one reason or the other, needs that level of support. It is when it is not her biological child that she is carrying, as compared to what we call traditional surrogacy, where the field began, when it was the woman's own biology used. Gestational surrogacy is when it is a separate biological source. So whether it is a heterosexual couple who's using their egg and sperm, or a same-sex couple who's using a donor egg and their sperm, to carry for them. So the carrier basically acts as just that, as someone who's able to carry a baby to term for those intended parents.
So, Anthony, why is it still illegal in New York?
That's a very good question. I think the current law was based on, it was kind of a knee-jerk reaction to the Baby M case, which happened in New Jersey, which was a traditional surrogacy case. And the surrogate mother changed her mind. And it was in the late 80s, early 90s. And both the courts of New York and New Jersey and the legislatures of New York and New Jersey decided that it should not be legal to do gestational care, gestational surrogacy or traditional surrogacy. New Jersey has since changed its law, but New York has been a little bit hesitant which I think surprises many people. And as someone who has worked to get the current legislation, which is called the Child Parent Security Act, passed in New York and has gone up to Albany to talk to some of the lawmakers about their reservations, it's an interesting journey. And I think that there's a lot of education that needs to take place and a lot of personal stories that need to be told.
Yeah, we'll get to those in just a moment. I know those that are against gestational surrogacy, Anthony, say that the recruiting can be aggressive, targeting low-income women who are financially vulnerable and might concede just because they need the money. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's an interesting and, in a way, mythological response, because the truth of the matter is there are such high standards for surrogates that claim suggests that agencies and individuals are not vetting the potential people who are coming to work with them and help their families grow. The truth of the matter is that agencies in particular, it's in their best interest to have the highest standards for finding their surrogate mothers. If someone is not, most agencies will not accept someone who is not of a certain economic class, someone who is not in a supportive relationship or family at the time, someone who, does not pass a psychological screening. So if someone is in any way coerced in doing this, they're not going to find their way to become a surrogate.
Jen, a moment ago we talked about sharing personal stories. Can you share yours with us?
Of course. So when I was 26 years old, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And, when we were ready to build a family, we weren't quite ready at 26. But fast forward a number of years later, exploring what option would be the right one for us. Basically, we had to determine whether we wanted to adopt or consider egg donation and surrogacy, and we felt that that was the right path for us. So we used a egg donor and a gestational carrier to have our son as a result, and he was born in 2012.
So when you hire a gestational surrogate, it's not illegal then, and Anthony maybe helps out with this, it's not illegal if you go out of the state of New York to find the surrogate then?
That's correct. The law in New York basically says that gestational surrogacy agreements are not enforceable in New York. So the key is where your surrogate gives birth. That's where the law starts to apply. So if your carrier is in New York and gives birth in New York, then you are under the current law, which not only makes those agreements unenforceable, but it also, there's a criminal penalty for both parents and anyone who assists those parents in that gestational surrogacy agreement.
So those gestational surrogates are typically not going to be in New York near the time of their due date, which that sets forth a whole other level of complexity for the parents because they have to travel out of the state, correct? Once their baby's being born.
Yes, and I can tell you from personal experience, that was the hardest part of my husband's and my surrogacy journey was knowing that Shannon, our carrier, was so far away from us. We really kind of wanted to be more a part of the pregnancy, but because of geographical reasons, we couldn't be.
And what kind of protections does the surrogate have that you talked about the Baby M case, that the parents are not going to back out of the deal?
That's a really good point to make, because gestational surrogacy agreements, I think some critics of surrogacy feel that they benefit only the parents. But gestational surrogates are coming into this agreement with the same amount of trust that the parents are going to hold up on their end as well. So the Child Parent Security Act is, number one, it is the most protective act, I think, of any of the pieces of legislation around this issue around the country. It has something in it called a Surrogate's Bill of Rights, which basically ensures that the surrogate has the sole decision-making you know, for her own health and for the fetus or embryo she's carrying during the pregnancy, that she has the right to terminate the pregnancy if she chooses on her own, and that prior to the pregnancy, under the Child Parent Security Act, she can leave the agreement without any penalty at all. The question that you asked suggests that the parents then are a little bit more in jeopardy under the Child Parent Security Act. I believe that all the parties, the intended parents and the surrogates who make it through the vetting process to be actually become a part of the journey, that they are all of the same mind, and that the Child Parent Security Act merely creates a protection mechanism and a framework in which all of their rights can be protected.
And what do you think the likelihood is that there will be a legalization of gestational surrogacy in New York coming up this year?
Well, I know that the governor is fully behind the Child Parent Security Act, and the Senate has passed the Child Parent Security Act in the past. I think the opposition lies in the Assembly, and it lies in a small segment of the Assembly. I think that there are certain groups that are concerned with women's rights issues. They are concerned that there is not a lot of long-term studies for instance, egg donor health issues. They want to make sure that the surrogate has autonomy, which is in the agreement itself, and the legislation itself. And also the legislation provides for an egg donor registry, which will begin to collect this health data to create long-term studies. So I think that if those who are opposed to gestational surrogacy actually meet a surrogate or meet a family through surrogacy, I think that's one of the most effective ways of changing hearts and minds around this issue. I know in the marriage equality movement, it was key to moving the issue forward. And I think it's going to be important in this legislation as well for people to get to know the parties that this law would benefit.
All right. Jen Rackman, an outreach associate for Circle Surrogacy, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
And attorney Anthony Brown is going to stay with us to talk more about gestational surrogacy and later on about the fertility needs of the LGBT couples that are in our area. But if you'd like to comment on today's show, email us at tfs@wshu.org or message us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. And you can listen to our podcasts on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Well, unlike New York, Connecticut is a surrogate-friendly state. Let's hear more now from Dr. Gad Levee. He is the medical director and founder of New England Fertility Institute in Stamford. Dr. Levee, thanks for being with us.
Yes, sure. My pleasure.
Tell us about the current laws in Connecticut regarding surrogacy and how different they are than that of New York.
So, just to put it in the perspective, I'm a physician, not an attorney.
Yes.
So I can talk about the medical part and just give you sort of my take on the legal aspect. But my understanding for surrogacy, and of course we're talking about what we call gestational surrogacy and not the traditional surrogacy. So gestational surrogacy is where you use IVF and a couple creates embryos and the surrogate has no genetic connection. So we talk about gestational surrogacy and we talk about commercial surrogacy versus altruistic surrogacy. And as I'm sure you know that the surrogacy laws are under state jurisdiction. Some states have written legislation, some states don't. And base the surrogacy laws on case law. So Connecticut actually happens to be one of the two most surrogate-friendly states in the country. So it's Connecticut and California. And this is, of course, in contrast to New York, where surrogacy commercial surrogacy is not legal. So the surrogate-friendly states basically facilitate both altruistic and commercial surrogacy. They enforce commercial surrogacy contracts. They allow the intended parents to establish legal parentage, and that is regardless of sexual orientation, marital status. And they also allow for what's called pre-birth order, where the child, actually the unborn child, can be registered as belonging to their parents, which means that when the child is born, their names and not the surrogate is on the birth certificate.
That's a very
so
good
Connecticut.
Connecticut
allows for all of this.
And what I was going to bring up, Anthony, is that as Dr. Levy mentioned about the name on the birth certificate, in New York, if the woman's name on the birth certificate is actually considered the mother. So in other words, the surrogate's name would be on the birth certificate as opposed to the mother who has hired the surrogate.
Well, the way that birth orders work, which is also contained in the Child Parent Security Act in New York, states will either have a pre-birth order or a post-birth order system. In a pre-birth order system, the petition is filed while the surrogate is pregnant. And essentially, the order is issued prior to the birth of the child, but it says upon the birth of the child is legally the child of the intended parents. And thus, that pre-birth order is given to the administration of the hospital, and the intended parents' names are put on the initial birth certificate. In states with post-birth order systems, basically an emergency petition is filed immediately upon the birth of the child, and then the original birth certificate, which may be or may not be issued with the surrogate's name, is then amended as a corrected birth certificate as soon as the order is issued, which is usually within a week of the birth of the child.
So it's complicated.
It is, but and it's also something that doesn't necessarily apply just to surrogacy. Pre-birth orders would be very beneficial for instance, single women who need donors to have children, or lesbian couples who need known donors to have children.
So, Dr. Levy, are you seeing patients coming from New York and they're coming to Connecticut because of Connecticut's surrogate-friendly laws and policies?
Oh, absolutely, yes. So we work with individuals as well as IVF clinics in New York that have basically started the process, created embryos, and from one reason or another, there's a need to use a surrogate, and of course they cannot complete the process in New York.
And how expensive is surrogacy in Connecticut versus that of New York? Is it about the same because of it's a more medically complicated series of procedures?
Well, just keep in mind that the surrogacy process, right, is a process that involves in vitro fertilization. And there's actually two parts to it. One part is where you create the embryos, and that depends on the situation. If it's a heterosexual couple or a same-sex couple, single person, so the eggs can come from, you know, the woman, the patient. They can come from an egg donor, the same with the sperm. So essentially the first part is creating the embryos. And the way the process is performed today is that we create the embryos first. We grow them to a point where we're sure that we're convinced that they're viable, and also do some genetic testing for the embryos, again, to be able to pick out the one embryo that has the best chance of success. And those embryos are then frozen and waiting for the surrogate to become available. So the first part is actually we do as a clinic, and we provide the donors, and we do the medical procedures, we do all the screenings. And then the second part, the surrogacy part, we work with surrogacy agencies. So the surrogacy agencies actually mostly are not in Connecticut. The surrogates that we work with are mostly not from Connecticut. As long as they live and give birth in a surrogate-friendly state, they can be from anywhere. So actually, the bulk of our surrogacy cases are surrogates that are live in other states. Connecticut is a small state, and for many different reasons, we don't really have too many women who are interested or willing to be surrogates in Connecticut.
I see. Go ahead.
So to your question about the cost, so the bulk of the cost, I would say, has to do with the surrogate.
All right.
Paying the surrogate, paying the agency, paying the attorney.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but Dr. Gadlevy, thank you so much as medical director and founder of New England Fertility Institute in Stanford for joining us. And Anthony Brown, attorney and surrogacy advocate in New York, you're going to stay with us. We'll take a break, and then we'll be right back. And welcome back to The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Sarandon for Ron Ropiak. We are talking about access to gestational surrogacy in our region. Well, is there a greater need for surrogacy as many couples start families later in life? And what about the LGBT community? A recent survey from the Family Equality Council says 63% of millennial LGBT couples are interested in becoming first-time parents. Still with us is Anthony Brown. He is a New York-based attorney and advocate for legalizing surrogacy in the state. Also joining us as well is Dr. Martin Cantor. He is the director of the Long Island Center for Socioeconomic Policy and a former Suffolk County Economic Development Commissioner. And also with us is David Kilmnick. He is the president of the LGBT Network on Long Island. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
All right, Dr. Cantor, I'll start with you a little bit away from IVS. In general, why are young people waiting so long to start families today?
Well, it's a whole lot of things. First, let me say hello, David. We've never met, but I've read a lot about you, and good to be on the show with you.
Thank you.
It has to do with millennials. And I think that we transcend whether it be race or gender preference or any other issues. When you're a millennial, what's happening that I find in my research and also speaking to people is that a lot of it has to do with the debt that they have, the jobs that they have that don't pay them the wages that their skill sets require, the cost of housing. All these things are putting off making the decisions of, number one, getting married, and number two, whether to have children or not. In fact, I have two children who are, one is just at the far end of the millennials, and the other one smack dab in the middle, who are not considering having children. So the issue really becomes whether I want children. And then when you make that decision, then the other factors come in with having difficulty having children, or whether you need a surrogate mother to have the baby.
So what about those that don't want to wait? Do you find that they just say, we're going to leave the area? We're going to go to a state where it's a lot easier to pay for a child, raise a child. Just life is more simple.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I write a biweekly column for Long Island Business News, which is the largest business weekly on the island. And this week, it's going to be on the people who have left New York State and Long Island. New York State's lost 77,000 people. They migrated out. And the less expensive states like Texas, Colorado, Arizona, those states with the cost of living, cost of housing, property taxes, cost of energy, they're all way lower than New York. And so we're finding that whereas New York businesses are saying we need skilled labor, that's skilled labor, which we have educated, by the way, to the tune of close to $300,000. These people are leaving New York State with the education we've paid for to less expensive places in the country. And with that affordable factor, that might encourage some people to think of raising a family earlier because they'll be able to afford a family.
So you're seeing a drain, a real brain drain in New York.
It's a people drain.
A people drain. Brains or no?
they obviously have brains because they're getting out of here because it's too expensive to live here.
All right.
But we're losing those people. And Long Island in particular has lost, over the last 2 years, 24,000 people, while we've had an inflow of migration by about 9,900. So Long Island is feeling that that exodus as well.
All right. David, getting into this segment, I read a statistic, 63% of millennial LGBT couples are interested in becoming first-time parents. What does the LGBT network do to help these couples start a family?
Sure. So at the LGBT Network, where we have several community centers, LGBT centers on Long Island and also in Queens, too, we stretch out to the in Long Island City. So we say we go from the Midtown Tunnel to Montauk. We have a family program that is for folks who are interested in starting a family, as well as for those that already have children. And part of that includes having seminars around surrogacy or adoption. We work with several different organizations and the Suffolk County Department of Social Services to make sure that people are certified to be adoptive, foster parents. But, you know, we've seen a big spike in those seeking surrogacy as a way to start a family. So we have support programs, educational. We link people up with other groups that either can certify them or that can provide the surrogacy services. We have events that bring families together so that the kids don't, you know, kids see families that look just like theirs. And it's really one of our fastest growing programs we have at the LGBT Network.
And do you find the cost of IVF and surrogacy, is that discouraging millennial LGBT couples?
You know, I mean, the cost is pretty high, but if it's, you know, if that's a route that folks want to go, they seem to be able to find the means to make it happen. And we do see more and more folks go down that road. And we also have a lot of folks who also take a look at the adoption and foster care system as well. You know, but surrogacy, for those that are looking for that, and there are so many more couples that are looking toward surrogacy, and you know that we were talking about millennials. And I think a large part of that reason is, you know, when marriage equality passed several years ago, that people are looking at their lives a little bit different about what's possible and being legally protected. And the legalization of surrogacy is real important. New York, I'm sure has been mentioned already, is one of only two states in the nation that does not have this legal. Michigan is being the other. So, you know, surrogacy can fulfill the prospective parents' lifelong dreams of completing their families. And so, you know, it allows the same-sex couples to have children with a biological connection to one or both parents. And it also allows for, you know, greater protection for the family all around.
And now, Anthony, at the very beginning of this show, we talked about insurance coverage and the big change this year for large corporations covering IVF. How has that changed now? And this includes LGBT couples. So we talked about a first round for IVF, $20,000 to $24,000. With insurance, what is the out-of-pocket on that?
Well, that's a good question, and it's going to be determined by the insurance providers. And this year we're going to start seeing statistics on that. And there probably will be several claims that will be denied. And for those who either have representation, certainly for surrogacy agencies who are sort of in control of the health insurance process, they will be making those claims. If it's a New York-based surrogacy, though, it's not until the Child Parent Security Act, we're not going to see any movement on that front. But if and when the Child Parent Security Act passes, I think that it's going to definitely assist couples in making the economic preparations for a surrogacy journey. It's definitely something that has to be considered and it has to be planned out. And any financial assistance provided to a couple is going to be a benefit.
And tell me about your website and how your website assists LGBT couples learning about having a family through surrogacy.
Sure. My website is timeforfamilies.com. And it's basically dedicated to assist the LGBT community in having families, and once they have them, protecting them. So there's information on there about, for lesbian couples, about choosing known donors versus anonymous donors, There's information about how to go through the surrogacy process ethically and with thought. There's information about estate planning. There's information about trust planning. So basically, the website is a clearinghouse for information that's collected from other sources and also information that I've written about LGBT family creation and protection.
And Dr. Cantor, do you anticipate any unintended consequences of state regulations now, state law requiring large companies provide the insurance coverage for IVF?
Increasing, I guess, the premiums that they might have employees, like they set up. They set up things known as cafeteria plans in businesses where those who want to use surrogacy can donate part of their salaries into that fund and be matched by the employers. So other than, the financial cost, the unintended consequences, if you've ever been a parent, I've got three kids. Yeah, that's the big unintended consequence. You got to raise three kids, both financially and emotionally, and that ain't easy. So that would be the unintended consequence. But other than that, everything is costing more these days, and it's certainly a cost factor. But, there's always the interesting part or the sad part, there's always abuse in terms of something like this. So what are the legal restrictions that the mother carrying the baby might not say, never mind, and here's your money back, I want to keep the kid? Or abuse of or the child wanting to know who the mother who carried her is, those kind of things, the transparency, those would be the unintended consequences that the law would have to really spell out, so when people engage in surrogacy, they know exactly what the requirements are and all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed. So what should be a happy occasion, the birth of a child, doesn't turn into litigation.
Yeah, and Anthony, Dr. Cantor earlier in this interview brought up the number of kids in foster care, and there are those that will say, why don't you adopt a child? There are so many kids in the system that are looking for a happy family that they can grow up in.
It's an interesting question because nobody asks that question of a heterosexual couple planning on having their family. And the options for same-sex couples are myriad. And it is certainly something that myself, my husband and I took into consideration. But it was important to us that we have our own biological child, that we were able to, to be able to see one of us in our children. And I was lucky enough to assist a lesbian couple in having their family as a known donor. So I understood what this process was like, but I think it's almost an insulting question to suggest that a gay couple should not have the right to make that decision to have their own biological family simply because there are children in foster care and there are children that need adoption. Certainly, there are couples that will seek them out specifically, but not all couples.
And I think that question is probably asked of those that are not same-sex couples as well about the going forward with adoption. But you bring up a good point, and that is stories of discriminatory practices. David, maybe I'll ask you about that. Have you heard stories of discriminatory practices when it comes to all of this and the LGBT community?
Certainly. And just going back to the question that was just asked, I agree in that, and a lot of times it may be asked innocently because it's like, hey, you're two guys or you're two men, you're two women, how are you going to have a baby? It takes them, and so a lot of times people point to the direction of foster care, adoption or foster care immediately, ignoring that, perhaps the same-sex couple wants to experience the same thing as heterosexual couples do, including key milestones from the embryo transfer to the baby's birth and all the stuff that happens during pregnancy. So I think, it is people's leaning to ask that question, immediately of same-sex couples, which ignores the fact that there's many other ways to have children. But yeah, no, we've seen plenty of discrimination against LGBT couples, you know, even within the foster care and adoption system too. And, you know, one of the things that we're working on here in Suffolk County is to, we do trainings for prospective adoptive and foster care parents, but it's optional for that session to take place. We're trying to have it become mandatory, you know, because, I mean, this is a different subject, but there are many LGBT young kids in the foster care system. And I don't think a lot of parents are maybe equipped, ready perhaps to have an LGBT child. And so, you know, there's discrimination, certainly. You know, certain people still think that, you know, children should be brought up with a mom and a dad, not two moms, not two dads. I mean, the reality is that most kids are being brought up by a mom or a dad, or by their grandparents. And so, you know, a lot of it is around bias, people's attitudes, and education is needed. But there still is discrimination within our systems.
And Anthony, do you think there are ways that anti-discrimination policies and regulations can be better enforced?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess the first step is to record any instances of discrimination, to have some kind of a database to get the kind of data that you need to show that there's a problem in the first place. One of the issues with adoption in particular is that, particularly if it's a private placement adoption, the birth mother also has to choose you. So there really can't be a restriction on her ability to choose where her biological child goes. But if the child comes through a foster care system or through a state-funded agency, and you are seeing some cases pop up around the country now about discrimination against gay couples from, for instance, adoption agencies or foster care agencies that have some kind of religious affiliation, I think that first of all, the action should be brought, the data should be collected, and then legislatures should take a good hard look at their own state and see what really is in the benefit of the children.
And Dr. Cantor, what role do you think governments play in the need to provide or to provide fertility services to state residents?
Well, my first answer is government should stay out of the bedroom. There aren't enough places as it is. But I think that what government should do is support groups like David's and your other guest and let them provide the services. They're close enough to the people. Very few things the government gets involved with that they don't screw up. And this is a delicate matter, and it should be in the hands of professionals who deal with the folks at the local level. I think government should provide the safeguards for the legislation, for the safeguards of this procedure and this practice. It should clearly delineate rights of everybody involved, and then, quite frankly, get out of the way and not intrude in you know, what should be a very happy occasion and a very delicate occasion. So that's my feeling on government.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with all of you today, and we've talked about this from so many perspectives. Dr. Martin Cantor, who you just heard from, is director of the Long Island Center for Socioeconomic Policy. Also with us in this past segment was David Kilnick, president of the LGBT Network on Long Island. And with us for a good portion of our program today was Anthony Brown, an attorney and a surrogacy advocate. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. It's been a very insightful discussion. And that's going to be it for this show. Sabrina Garone is our engineer. Our associate producers are Fatu Sangari, Roberto Rojas, Desiree DiOrio, and Sabrina Garone. And Carrie Frank is our digital editor. J.D. Allen is our producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. And I'm Rebecca Saran and Varun Ropiak. Thank you for being part of today's Full Story.